every Thursday. Please email the info to blueshound@kpft.org. That's BLUESHOUND @kpft.org. You're listening to KPFT Houston.
Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch signals Thursday, 8 p.m. and time for So What's Your Story. We're the only program originating in Houston devoted to live storytelling, and we're right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM Houston. I'm Warren Holloman. Tonight I'll be your host. Each week, Hank, Greg, Mary, Tatiana, and I, along with our extended family of guest hosts and guest storytellers, each week we celebrate the power of story by bringing you remarkable tellers who take us on captivating journeys, and then they bring us safely home. This week we're going to do things a bit differently. With the help of outstanding actors from one of Houston's finest theaters, we're going to present an old-fashioned radio play. We're doing this to honor one of Houston's most vital storytellers, the Holocaust Museum Houston, which has just completed a 2-year expansion project. The museum is doubling in size and will celebrate with a grand reopening next week. You heard me right. I referred to a museum as a storyteller. In fact, I believe that museums tell some of the most important stories of all. That's an epiphany C.G. Isaacson had back in 1981. C.G., a Holocaust survivor and a longtime Houston resident, was in Israel, attending a gathering of Holocaust survivors. As he looked around the room, he realized that his peers were getting older, and as they passed away, their stories would die with them. Isaacson returned to Houston with a vision for creating a museum and a memorial that would preserve for future generations the memory of those who had perished and the stories of those who had survived. These stories would be retold as a way of teaching future generations about the dangers of hatred, prejudice, and apathy. Well, in 1996, Isaacson's dream became a reality, and over the years, the Holocaust Museum grew. It's now the fourth largest Holocaust museum in the United States. The Holocaust Museum Houston is also the first Holocaust museum to become completely bilingual, in Spanish as well as English. Like Mr. Isaacson, Ruth Steinfeld is another Houston resident, Holocaust survivor, and thanks to the Holocaust Museum Houston, she too is a storyteller. These are her words about the power of stories. Quote, "Before we had a museum, we never talked about the Holocaust. Who would want to know? But now we have a place to tell our stories. The museum has given me the strength to tell the world about my story and to honor the memory of the 1.5 million children who, unlike me, did not survive. Tonight, to honor the memory of these children and this museum and these storytellers, we're going to take you back in time and tell a story about the years leading up to the Holocaust. The story is an excerpt from a play I've written called Beyond the Pale. Many of you will recognize the Pale as a reference to the Pale of Jewish Settlement, a region in Eastern Europe where Jews were required to live according to strict rules of segregation. And they suffered there from poverty, persecution, and pogroms, among other things. It was essentially a prescription for genocide. Just about the only way a Jewish boy could escape the Pale was by being forcibly recruited into the Russian army and serving, and somehow surviving, for 25 years. Just about the only way a Jewish girl could escape was by registering as a prostitute. She would receive a special visa called a yellow card and would be housed in a brothel in a big city like Moscow or St. Petersburg. So that's what life was like for Jews around the turn of the 20th century. As for Russians, they play a big part in this radio story as well. And so let me just tell you a couple of things about the Russians. If you visited Moscow and St. Petersburg during this era, around the turn of the 20th century, I think two things would stand out. One is the materialism of the culture, and with that, a lack of spiritual depth. And the other thing that would stand out is that marital infidelity during this era was the norm, not the exception. So, with that background information, now, with the help of actors Shelby Marie Blocker, Jennifer Dean, and Kevin Dean from 80 Players, we will tell the story of Rivka, a Jewish girl from the Pale. The story is set in the city of Moscow in the year 1911. The Russian Empire is on the brink of collapse, and so is Boris. Boris, a Russian attorney and a leader of the Duma, which is the Russian parliament, he's been a very successful professional, but now his glory days are ending, because Boris has developed a serious illness, and he and his family are struggling to adapt. One evening, Boris's wife and daughter go to the opera. They left Boris at home in bed, taking a nap. 2 hours later, enter Rivka, an 18-year-old refugee from Ukraine. She immigrated to Moscow with a yellow card visa, but instead she works surreptitiously as Boris's nurse. She knocks gently on Boris's bedroom door, and then she speaks.
Mr. Nikvolodov? Hello? You took a nap, sir.
Oh, I was having the most horrible... I dreamed I was abandoned by a faulty syllogism.
Abandoned by who?
By whom? Not who. Whom?
Is there something I can get you? A glass of water?
Whom? Whom?
Me, sir.
When I was in school, we had to get our syllogisms right, or we were doomed. Just before she left this evening, Praskovya got her syllogism wrong. She's my wife. How could she do that to me?
I am so sorry.
First, she told me she was tired.
Which is true.
Then she told me I needed to rest.
You do?
Then she said she would be back soon. Think about that. Is there any logical connection between the two premises and the conclusion? The sicker I get, the longer she stays away.
So your wife is mostly right. You are tired and you do need rest. Therefore, it follows logically that someone should be here to take care of you. And I'm right here.
Now that is a good syllogism. You should be in Berlin studying the new philosophy.
I would like that very much.
Well, you must long for something more exciting than this. This is the prime of your life.
My father said if you take care of a sick person or an old person, it's the same as taking care of the Lord. I think about that a lot.
And when you are here, do you know what I think about?
Sir?
Well, let's just say I do not feel so sick or old. I actually feel vigorous.
Rivka leaves the bedside and begins straightening the other side of the room.
Perhaps you'd be interested in doing some extra work. I'd pay you well, and we could agree in advance to make the arrangement temporary.
It would have to be temporary, sir. You are dying.
Touché. You're not supposed to say such things to me, but I like it, and I suppose I deserve it.
You are not supposed to say what you said to me either, but in my case, I don't like it, and I don't think I deserved it.
Oh, I don't think you understand. I am complimenting you.
I don't think you understand.
Well, let's change the subject. I propose we talk about the scriptures.
Jews get nervous when Russians talk about the scriptures.
Did your father teach you what King David's doctors did for him when he was becoming an older gentleman?
He taught me that King David, young or old, was nothing close to being a gentleman.
Well, the scripture says that as the king got older, he had difficulty getting himself
warm. Do you know what that means?
I think I do. It means it's time for me to check the soup.
Do you know what the medical doctors did for King David?
I know what they should have done. They should have given him a cold bath and told him to behave like an older gentleman.
Actually, they cured him. And do you know how? The doctors, medical professionals, that is, they hired a nurse. A special type of nurse. A young, pretty nurse.
And this was supposed to be a good thing?
Yes! It worked! The Holy Scripture says the king got warm.
Perhaps it worked for him. I can promise you it did nothing for her.
Oh, you're too smart for me. Let's change the subject again. Tell me about your father.
What about my father?
What does he do?
What does he do?
His profession, his hobbies.
What does he do? Where I come from, what we do, what we all do, is work. Mm. And I'll tell you what we don't do. Mm? We don't have stupid fights over Japanese curtains or Persian caviar or Finch pastries, for that matter.
I take it your parents only have domestic disputes.
We work.
I'm making a joke. When troubles boil on foreign soil, that's Shakespeare. You should read him.
When troubles boil on foreign soil, double, double, toil and trouble.
Now, how did you know that?
I said we were poor. I didn't say we were stupid.
You said you were from Ukraine.
So?
Well, these are educated Russians who don't know Shakespeare.
At night, we lit a candle and took turns reading to each other.
Shakespeare, your father is Haskalah.
What?
Well, I assumed he was Hasid.
What do you know about Hasid?
It's the traditional way, but Haskalah,
I know what Haskalah is, but I didn't know that you knew.
Well, maybe I'm not stupid either.
A lot of Jews don't know Haskalah, and if they do, they don't like it.
Hmm. Your father is a most interesting man.
One night, when I was a little girl, I couldn't sleep. It was Shabbat, so the lamp was burning. I heard somebody get up, and then I saw Papa's shadow by the lamp. He started turning down the lamp, little by little, to make it look as though the oil was running out, in case someone was awake. He didn't know it, but I could see. I saw my own father commit a monstrous sin. I held my breath. I thought lightning would strike him dead. The next Shabbat, I secretly stayed awake again, and again the same thing. I told no one. Years later, I got the courage to ask. He said that when I was a child, I tossed and turned when the light was on. He said a child needs her sleep. He risked his soul to be kind to me. Later, he told me a funny joke. He said that he had been born into a medieval society, but he was determined to die in the Enlightenment. That way he would only be 2 centuries behind the rest of Europe.
I would like to meet your father.
2 years ago, he got sick. For weeks, he coughed up his blood, and then his lungs, and then his life.
Oh.
After it was over, I stayed to work his jobs and pay his debts, and then I came here.
I'm sorry you had to experience that.
I'm not. I would not trade those last weeks for all the rubles in the world.
You wanted to be with your father when he was sick?
Is that so strange?
Russians prefer pleasant things.
When Papa was sick, he told me things. He said when I was a baby, I had trouble sleeping then, too. He said Mother would put her undergarments in my crib. Have you ever heard of such a thing?
Her underwear.
Mother believed that I would smell her and sleep the way a baby is supposed to sleep, with her mother close by. When Papa was sick, he would hold my hand and pray for me. At first, his grip was so strong that my hands ached. At the end, I was the one holding his hand.
When Jewish father prays for his daughter, what does he say?
Whatever is in his heart. My father always prayed the same prayer. Bless Rivka. May she find a roof for her head, food to fill her, and a friend to hold her.
That's it?
Well, he said he would have prayed for a liberal government in Russia, but he did not want the Lord to think him greedy. Papa always borrowed his books. But just before he died, he purchased a book for me. What is to be done? By Nikolai Chernevsky. It's not the type of book you would approve of.
Did you like Vera Pavlovna?
You know Vera Pavlovna?
Well, I know she's a modern woman. A fictitious modern woman. I know that she became a doctor, like Kasernarovna. I know that she abandoned her bourgeois marriage and faced life alone.
Dr. Kasernarovna is not a fictitious woman. How do you know Vera Pavlovna?
When I was your age, if a girl wanted to show she was liberal, she would cut her hair, smoke cigarettes, read this book. If a boy liked this girl, he would read it too.
I thought the government banned this book.
That's why we all read it.
Madame Praskovya, she read this book.
This was before I met Praskovya. There was another girl, Oksana.
You were in love with a Jewish girl.
Things were easier in those days. This was before Alexander II was assassinated, before they pinned the blame on a Jew, before they passed the May laws as retribution. Yes, I was in love with Oksana, as in love as any 18-year-old boy can be. But she read this book and suddenly left. She moved to Berlin.
Just like Vera Pavlovna.
If only Oksana had been born a man. She would have been happy.
No girl in her right mind would want to be a man.
You just said yourself. Vera Pavlovna.
I said Vera Pavlovna wanted the same rights as men.
Is that what you want?
That's what every woman wants.
This is Russia. You may have to wait a long time. Or move to Berlin.
My turn to change the subject. After you die, how do you want people to remember you?
No.
Then I'll put it this way. Mm-mm. How do you not want people to remember you?
Are you serious?
No. Just for fun. What is the worst obituary that you could imagine?
We were having a perfectly normal conversation, and then you say, just for fun, what is the worst obituary you could imagine? Jews talk this way.
You're a clever man. Give it a try.
I can't believe I'm... Boris Nikvoldovov was a clumsy fool who killed himself trying to fix the curtains. Because they were off-center, and by 1 centimeter, and 10 feet above the floor.
I like that.
When I was your age, climbing tall ladders was no problem. Actually, I was a bit of an athlete.
I am sure you were.
I was the strongest and the fastest boy in my class. I had the eye of many girls.
I'm not surprised.
We met in the cafes, we drank coffee, plotted revolution, and then we made love. That's what you do when you're 18 years old, right? Sometimes an older man can be a good teacher for younger women.
Oy vey.
Perhaps you are not aware, but a true gentleman always uses clean linen.
Sir.
Stop reading Tolstoy. Go back to Shakespeare. Sex is natural. It's what men and women do.
It's what animals do. Howling at the moon, scratching bark off trees, acting like lunatics.
There is a difference between animals and gentlemen, trust me.
Given the choice between trusting you and trusting Tolstoy,
I'll
take Tolstoy.
The sexual needs of adults are well understood by modern science.
Most scientists being men.
To stay healthy, a man must attend to the needs of his libido.
Then you do that, and I'll go cook the soup.
Do you know what happens when a river doesn't flow? It becomes stagnant. Stagnation leads to disease, death.
Let me check to see if I have this right. You're saying your putz is going to rot, and then it's going to fall off, and then you're going to blame that on me?
If you studied medical science, you would understand.
I would very much appreciate the opportunity to study medical science.
Boris moves in and grabs Rivka's hands.
Then perhaps I could give you that opportunity.
Sir?
You must feel something in your heart.
What are you doing?
I can help you, and you can help me.
No.
Trust me.
Please.
Rivka breaks away from his grasp.
You're a young woman. Surely you have feelings.
No.
Just one time, tell me your feelings.
Please, don't make
Just
me do that.
Just one time for me. Say whatever comes to your mind.
What comes to mind? A dog, looking for a tree to rub his balls against.
What?
And if you really must know, it's an old mangy dog.
Stop.
Limping around on three legs.
I said stop.
You asked me to speak. You insisted I tell you the truth, and then you said I could trust you. Does your conclusion follow from your premises, or were you just saying whatever it took to get you whatever you want?
I didn't ask you to insult me.
Ask? You begged for it.
Sometimes you forget I'm sick.
Sometimes you forget you're sick. Your sexual function isn't the only thing that's broken. You should check your brain.
Once you start, do you ever stop?
Do you?
I assumed my illness might have stirred a modicum of compassion, especially from a person in your situation.
What is that supposed to mean?
You know exactly what I mean. It wasn't easy getting you a yellow card. Bureaucracy, bribes, I stuck my neck out.
Let me clear up something right now. I refuse to be defined by your yellow piece of paper. I am not what you and the gentlemen in the parliament say I am.
For your information, it was I and other gentlemen in the Duma, or parliament as you call it, who are setting Russia on a path toward constitutional government. We stuck our neck out, too. That is something I'm proud of.
Then remind me to genuflect every time I enter your room.
Is this the first time a man tried to seduce
you? That's none of your business, but it's certainly the first time a man refused to let me check the soup.
If you knew the changes I've been fighting for, I think you'd be impressed. Suffrage for women, religious freedom for Jews, labor unions for workers. We're not there yet, but we are.
If you had changed in the past few years, then I would be impressed.
Young lady, sometimes you forget who I am. I just happen to be one of the most powerful men in Russia, lest you...
And sometimes you forget who I am. So let me tell you. You, sir, are speaking to a girl who did work, real work, every day, starting before sunrise and finishing after sunset, from the time she was 7 years old. You call yourself a bit of an athlete. A bit is all you were. You spent 99% of your life sitting on your ass. And while we're at it, let me remind you who you are. You get all puffed up about winning a bridge tournament, but you run and hide when someone challenges you about the real stuff that life is made of. You fight these lofty parliamentary battles, then you come home and fight against your own family. Your daughter wants nothing more than to be with and to be like her father, yet you're afraid to ask her what is on her mind. I do not find this behavior manly.
That's enough.
You brag about your infidelity. And I am supposed to be impressed by your manly conquests? Yet if your daughter did what you do, or what you're asking me to do, you would call her a slut and a whore.
I said stop!
You brag about government reforms, yet your people destroy your chattels and commit atrocities against our children. And no one is punished. Jewish girls come to your city. We are seeking refuge. And you treat us like we're the criminals. Your so-called reforms permit me to stay here only on one condition, that I register. And register as what? I don't hear you. You're ashamed, and you should be.
It was a compromise. Legislation requires compromise.
There was no compromise required for you or any of the other gentlemen who made this law. You force desperate refugees, who just happen to be young, pretty girls, into sexual slavery, and then you cast it as an act of charity. Have you no shame? Jewish parents raise their girls just the way you raised your girl. And it was not to compromise. And then you have the audacity to quote our scriptures to serve your purposes? I don't know a whole lot, but I know one thing. You're no King David, and I'm not your whore. I shall pack my bag and leave in the morning. If you would pay me this week's wages, I would be obliged.
You're outside the pale. You'd be deported and face charges.
I'm the one who's outside the pale. You live outside the pale of every normal human experience, and you don't even know it. You are supposedly married, but you pursue every woman and every girl except your wife. Technically speaking, you have a family, but all your family does is tell lies and keep secrets and play games. Now an illness is casting you outside the pale of life itself, and you don't know how to die or how to live until you die.
I am sick. I am in pain. You should show me some respect.
There you go again. Another faulty syllogism.
Oh, Christ.
It's true that you are sick. But this does not oblige me to agree with everything you say. It is true that you are in pain, but this does not exempt you from your responsibilities as a husband, a father, as a man, for that matter.
There are thousands of refugees out there. I thought you were desperate.
You're the one who's truly desperate, and you don't even know it. If you would kindly provide me those wages, I will leave in the morning.
How about we make a deal? From now on, I promise to let you check the soup.
Like you said, there are plenty of girls out there. You'll find one. And that will be a sad day because your wife and daughter, they are the ones who should be caring for you.
They're busy with other things.
Perhaps they would not be so busy if you would stop pushing them away. Perhaps they would like for you to pull them back.
That's not what Russian men do.
So you can address the Duma, the mighty senators, but you can't figure out what to say to your own family?
Forget medical school. I'm signing you up for law school. The best legal minds in Russia work for me, but all they do is tell me what they think I want to hear.
Which is ironic, given that your people call me a prostitute. Do you know how it feels to carry this yellow card everywhere I go? How would you feel if your daughter had to carry such a card?
Here. I added some extra. You'll need that to bribe the police.
Thank you.
It would be so much easier if you were baptized and took a Russian name. I could arrange that.
Then I'd be a real prostitute.
I have a different card for you. I think you'll like it. if you wait a week and call on this man.
Boris hands card to Rivka.
David Ginsburg, President, Society for the Promotion of Enlightenment Among the Jews of Russia. You know these people?
He has good connections. Some of the universities will admit Jews. Not many universities, and not many Jews, maybe two or three each year. A smart girl like you, he'll do his best to help you.
You are crazy. I never attended one day of school in my whole life.
You are highly educated, and you don't even know it. Your father was your teacher, and he was the best, and I will make sure David Ginsburg knows that. Speaking of your father, I have a question. When you were growing up, did your father ever tell you stories about the Russian army?
2 minutes ago, you asked me for a blowjob. Now you want a history lesson?
Surely you can indulge me with a history lesson. Where you grew up, were there stories about how the army recruited?
Jewish boys?
Jewish boys.
There were a few stories. More was untold than told.
And?
Papa had an older brother, half-brother. He was taken at age 10. I believe conscripted is the official term, the term your government uses to assuage his guilt.
And?
That's the end of the story. Nobody ever hears from these boys again.
He didn't write letters. He didn't go on leave.
Most likely he died of homesickness when he was 11. If he made it through that first year, he probably died the next from the tortures he received for refusing Christian baptism. If he survived that, he would have had many inglorious opportunities to die over the next few years. Malnutrition, exposure, pneumonia, dysentery. Maybe he was shipped off to the Turkish War where he died on the front lines. We have a saying. Jewish boys make good shields for Russian soldiers.
But what if he survived? After 25 years, he would have been discharged, right?
By that time, he would have forgotten who he was and where he came from. Most likely, he would be condemned to spending the last years of his life wandering around the Pale, begging for food and a blanket, searching for a familiar landmark, a familiar face, a familiar voice. We call these people the Luftmenschen, the people of the air.
What if he had a good memory? What if he remembered exactly who he was and where he came from, but he was ashamed?
Because he took the Christian baptism?
It was necessary to survive.
We do not speak of those people. As far as we are concerned, they no longer exist.
They were children.
For us, who we are and what we believe is everything. It's all we have.
They were tortured.
It would be an unremitting, lifelong shame.
You of all people, you're punishing the victim.
That's what you do when you have no power to punish the criminal.
This is the 20th century.
Really? Welcome to my world.
Boris begins to cry.
Sir?
I guess you could say it's my world, too.
Boris picks up a box and hands it to Rivka.
This belonged to my father. You are the only one who knows.
It belonged to your father. Now it belongs to Lizanka.
How do I tell her?
I don't know. But let me teach you something my father taught me, and maybe that will help. It's unconventional, and I'm pretty sure Dr. Kasha-Varovna would not approve.
Good. I like it already.
First, you need to sit on the edge of the bed. Now lie flat on your back.
What?
Push back just a little further. I'm going to lift your leg.
She puts his leg on her shoulder.
Now?
She puts the other leg on her other shoulder. She places pillows underneath him.
Okay.
Now breathe. Slow. When the blood flows out of the legs and back to the heart, then it will be time to lower them.
Or when we hear Praskovya returning, that would be a good time to lower them as well.
Shh. That's it.
I just remembered something. The first syllogism they taught us in school. Alexander is a man, men are mortal, therefore Alexander is mortal.
Alexander will die?
Alexander will die.
Whom is Alexander, sir?
Who?
Alexander.
Who? Alexander is a who.
Who?
I used to think Alexander was some mythical figure from thousands of years ago. Now I'm not so sure. Do you think Alexander ever ran a race or kicked a ball?
I believe Alexander was the strongest and the fastest. He kicked that ball further and harder than all the other boys, and he had the eye of all the girls.
Boris smiles. There's a silence. Praskovya and Lizanka enter suddenly and gasp. End of scene. If you're just joining us, this is So What's Your Story on 90.1 KPFT Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 in Huntsville. Tonight we're doing a special show in honor of the Holocaust Museum in Houston. We're telling the story of Rivka, an 18-year-old Jewish refugee from Ukraine who has made her way to Moscow to escape the poverty, pogroms, and persecution of life in the Pale of Jewish Settlement. The previous scene ended with Rivka lifting Boris's legs. Her intention was to help Boris with his circulation. But when Boris's wife, Praskovya, and daughter, Lizanka, suddenly returned home from the opera, they assumed something else was happening. Boris's daughter, Lizanka, is the same age as Rivka. They're both 18 years old. And up until that moment, Lizanka had felt a close bond with Rivka. Now she's not so sure. The next morning, very early, Lizanka perambulates into a slightly darkened living room. She's half asleep, wearing her robe. She has a French pastry in one hand and a cup of tea in the other. Rivka's duffel bag is in the middle of the living room floor because Rivka's preparing to leave, and Lizanka doesn't see it. Lizanka trips, shrieks, and falls down, spilling everything. Lizanka lies on the floor for a few seconds, then pulls herself up to a sitting position, and then she speaks.
Jesus, Mary and Joseph! I said Jesus, Mary and Joseph!
Is something wrong?
What do you think? I have no tea, I have no bread.
Good, now you know how the rest of the world feels.
How could you know how the world feels? You do not even know how I feel.
I thought you were asleep.
After what happened last night, you thought I could sleep? Where are you going?
Your father is sick. You should be taking care of him.
Well, I could never manage his affairs the way you do.
Things are not always as they appear. Ask Mr. Nikovolodov.
Well, I will do no such thing. He is my father.
Pardon me. I forgot it was taboo for parents and children to actually talk with each other. I was not raised in such enlightened culture.
And I forgot you were raised on a farm among animals. Is that where you learned your techniques of copulation?
A question about technique from the girl who flaunts her bosom at the theater as though it were some sort of Olympic sport.
You are jealous because you have no bosom to flaunt.
That is not what Mr. Fyodor Petrovich thinks, or half the other men who call on you.
I don't believe you.
Men. They all want the same thing. The three C's.
Compassion, commitment, caring?
Where have you been? They want us to cook, to clean, and to copulate, and not necessarily in that order.
And what makes you such an expert?
I read it in a book.
From what I observed last night, you must have written Chapter 3.
I was elevating his legs, something you should be doing, not me.
No!
You remind me of Jonah, swallowed by the whale. Bad things happen when people refuse to face their fears.
Maybe. Or maybe bad things happen when Jews make their bed amongst Gentiles. They get everybody in trouble.
The reason Jonah got everybody in trouble had nothing to do with whether he was a Jew. It was because he was afraid. He was running away from God. I am not the one running away from God. It was no accident that you fell across my bag. You wanted something before I jump overboard.
You are not jumping anywhere. You are my friend. You can't leave. Are you going home to ask your mother to find you a fiancé?
Why should I do that when I can just get your mother to loan me one of yours?
Well, your mother, she has... Has she found you a husband?
No.
Well, she is a Jew, yes?
So?
Jewish mothers, they make matches.
My mother is a type of Jew who does not make matches.
Huh. I did not know there was such a Jew.
She is a special type of Jew.
What type of Jew does not make matches?
Could we talk about something else?
Well, I want to know.
Why?
Tell me, what type of Jew is your mother?
Dead. My mother is a dead Jew.
What?
She is dead. And now I must go.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. What was she like?
You are Russian. There are things you do not want to know.
Perhaps, but as a human being, I must know.
What would you like to know? That her hands were rough from all the work she did? That she went barefoot in winter so my brother and I could have shoes?
In winter?
In the chateau, that's what mothers do.
That's beyond anything I've ever imagined.
And it's all I've ever known. Until I came here.
Is that how your mother died? When she went barefoot in winter?
If I told you my mother was killed by a recipe, would you believe me? My little brother was 2 years old. It was Passover, and a Russian boy was murdered by his stepfather. Guess who got the blame?
Not the stepfather?
No. The Yids. Now, do you know the ingredients for matzo?
Flour, water?
Where I come from, there's one more ingredient, at least according to the Russians. It comes from an old medieval legend about us, the Yids. You'll never guess it, so I'll just tell you. But after I tell you, it won't matter because you won't believe me. But even if you don't believe me, trust me, one day you will learn. And you will know. I can't tell you how I know this, but I do. So what have we got? Flour?
Flour.
Water?
Water.
And?
And?
Blood.
Yuck!
And not just any blood. The blood of Gentile children.
That's ridiculous.
The Russian peasants think that we go out every Passover and sacrifice a child to get the secret ingredient for our soup. They think we drink the child's blood. They think we're vampires.
This is the 20th century!
It was around the time of Passover, and this Gentile child was found dead. Everybody knew about the stepfather, but that didn't feed their narrative. That didn't give them the blood they were looking for. So these peasants, they formed a lynch mob. Kill the Yids. Kill the dirty Yids. It didn't help that some stupid priest threw fuel on their fire.
I'm listening.
He just had to preach his Easter sermon about how Christ was murdered by the Yids. The devil Yids. The vampire Yids. It was a Sunday afternoon. I was 7 years old. We heard this shouting. They were coming through the village, destroying everything. And then they did what they did.
Where were the police?
There. So was the priest.
No.
He held this huge, hideous cross. He was waving it like a sword. I'll hate the cross as long as I live.
Keep going.
5 men knocked down our door and ripped our house apart. They grabbed my brother and carried him into the street. My parents followed, begging and praying and getting beaten all at the same time.
They killed your brother?
They did things animals would not do. After it was over, my mother picked up my brother. He was still alive. She carried my brother into the house. She put him on the bed, what was left of it, what was left of him. My mother crawled into the bed. She stayed there for a few months. I tried to feed her, but she refused to eat. And all that time, my father, he refused to talk.
You were 7 years old.
After she died, my father finally spoke. He told me it was good. He said he was happy. He said my mama was going to heaven to take care of my brother. I panicked, because I figured he would go too, to take care of mama. But he said God wanted him to stay here to take care of me. The evening after my mother died, there was a storm. Papa grabbed an axe, just like the axe they used to kill my brother. He ran out to the place where my mother had just been buried. I was terrified. I watched him through the rain. Each time the lightning struck, I saw the silhouette of my father swinging the axe over and over, hitting the ground as hard as he could. Oh, I thought he was hitting my mother. It was horrific. Then I realized he had tied canvas over my mother's grave so she could stay dry. He was beating the stakes deeper into the ground, trying to protect my mother.
Rivka.
The next morning, I walked out to my mother's grave. Nobody told me that dead people don't eat, so I took her breakfast. I saw where my father had been beating the ground. There were 100 holes, very deep.
So he was angry.
I knelt down in one of those holes. I can still feel the cold water on my knees. I told God that I would take better care of my father than I had my mother. In exchange, I asked God to let me keep my father.
And?
That night, I told my father my prayer. He held me close. And for a very long time.
Lights fade. End of scene. Well, there you have it, Rivka's story, which is the story of Jews in Eastern Europe in the decades leading up to the Holocaust. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to meet the actors. But first, Tatiana?
So, you know, this is all really really interesting stuff. I remember when I would learn about the Holocaust in school, but it was never anything like this. I was bothering Dr. Rubicek the entire time, asking him questions, especially about, like, the yellow card, for example. Like, I never knew what any of that is. So, like, throughout this, for me, this was, like, more of a, this was a lesson as well. Like, I felt really educated hearing this. But, you know, our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, hosts a story swap the fourth Tuesdays of the month at Temple Emanuel across from Rice University. It's a great place to meet other storytellers, hear stories, or try out a story of your own. And if you visit the Guild's website, you'll see an archive of all of our previous shows. Just click on the radio programs tab and you'll be in story heaven. Hundreds and hundreds of great stories to listen to. And the Moth Grand Slam is next Wednesday, June 19th at the Ballroom at Bayou Place. The theme will be The Heat Is On. And our own Eric Keane and Harwood Taylor will be telling stories. You don't want to miss this. They will tell such wonderful stories. And in fact, Harwood and Chris will host next week, and it's something you definitely do not want to miss. And whether it's next week's show or any of our shows, you don't need a radio to listen to us. You can listen online at www.kpft.org. You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. If you have ideas for shows, we'd love to hear from you. You can contact us on our Facebook page, and we promise to get back to you.
And thank you, Tatiana. And we'll say more about that yellow card a little later, because that's an important thing to talk about. But I promised to introduce these fine actors. Shelby Marie Blocker, who played the role of Lizanka, the daughter of Boris, is the props manager for 80 Players. She has a BFA in acting from the University of Houston. She's designed and painted sets for just about every theater company in Houston. And she's performed as an actor in a number of Houston theaters as well. She's worked for several years as a performance and stagecraft teacher with Main Street Theater, and she's currently working with Hope Stone's Theater Outreach Program. Kevin Dean, who played Shelby's father, Boris, or Lizanka's father, is in his 19th year with the 80 Players, where he has worked as an actor and director, and now he also serves as artistic director. He has also co-written two Lifetime Network movies. Is that, I think.
That's true.
Yeah, way to go. I've never written a movie. A Woman Betrayed and The Preacher's Sin. Jennifer Dean, who played the role of Rivka, is the marketing director of 80 Players. Over the past 20 years, she has acted and directed in dozens of Houston productions in such theaters as Main Street, Fourth Wall, Classical Theater Stages, and of course, 80 Players. And I have to add, she just directed an amazing play called Collected Stories at Fourth Wall. I know this is physically impossible, but I gave it three thumbs up.
So, thank you, Warren.
Two thumbs and a big toe.
There we go.
There it is.
Shelby, Kevin, and Jennifer, thank you, and welcome to So What's Your Story?
Oh, thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
And I probably should add, just on a personal note, I believe that Jennifer and Kevin are actually related.
That is true.
We are.
We are married.
Yes.
That's right. Correct?
That, yeah. That is correct.
And they have a child who's got a birthday coming.
Yeah. Our daughter turns 3 in 2 weeks. So we're in preparations for the dinosaur-themed birthday party.
Yep. Yep.
That's so great. And Shelby is not entirely new to my life, because 3 years ago she played the role of Lizanka in an earlier reading of this play. So I'm delighted to have you back as well, Shelby.
It's a delight to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's begin where at a place where 80 Players and the Holocaust Museum and tonight's story, radio play, all interface. Your upcoming production of The Hiding Place.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin, you're the director of The Hiding Place.
Yes.
So give us just in a nutshell, for those who may not be familiar with that story, what's that story all about?
The story is about Corrie ten Boom and her family. They lived in the Netherlands, and they helped, they weren't Jewish, but they helped hide the Jews during the German occupation of Harlem and during World War II. And then there was, spilled the beans on them, and they were part of the resistance. And as the Germans were sort of investigating the resistance, someone tattletaled on them, and they were then taken to different concentration camps. Her father died 10 days after he was captured. Corrie and her sister Betsy were taken to Ravensbrück. Corrie was actually released. Her sister died in Ravensbrück, and Corrie was released on a clerical error. This is all spoiler alerts when you come see the play. I apologize, I'm giving away the whole plot. But it's an amazing story about these women and their faith and how their faith sort of carried them through the Holocaust.
And there's a connection that your theater has to the movie version of this story.
Yes.
Which the movie actually saw back when I was in college 40 some years ago.
Yeah.
Maybe could you comment
on that?
Sure.
Our founder was Jeanette Cliff George. She founded the theater back in 1967. She started as an actress in New York and then at the Alley Theater in the 50s and 60s. And then she started the 80 Players in 67. And when she was in New York, she had a connection to Billy Graham and his ministry. They did a lot of work with the artists and actors up in New York during the time. And so she ended up auditioning for The Hiding Place and was cast as Corrie. Mm-hmm. So she played Corrie ten Boom in the film The Hiding Place, and she was nominated for a British Academy Award. She was nominated for a Golden Globe Award and got a lot of recognition for that.
So this is we are commissioning a playwright. So this is a world premiere production of The Hiding Place that will open our season next year, a show that's close to the 80 Players' hearts and her history, and kind of a tribute in some ways to Jeanette. She passed away in December of 17. And so, a way to continue the legacy that she left for 80 Players. It's exciting.
Yeah.
And Shelby gets to do all the props for that.
Yes. Very exciting and a little bit depressing, but mostly exciting.
Yeah. Well, I still remember the movie vividly from long ago. And when I moved to Houston, and then I found out that Jeanette Cliff George, who was kind of a movie star at the time, lived here. I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, she was born here. She grew up here. Then she went to the University of Texas and then to New York. Uh-huh. And then eventually she came back to Houston as a part of the Ford Foundation, gave the Alley Theater a grant to bring in New York actors. And she was a part of that group. So then she came back home to work for the Alley Theater and Nina Vance for many, many years.
Wow. And when is the production?
We open in September.
Okay.
I think September 13th.
Yes, September 13th, and we run through October 13th.
Okay. And just one more question, and then I'm going to bring Hank in. I want to get Shelby in on the conversation, too. As actors, what's it like to take on the role of historical characters? The ones in the play tonight and the ones in The Hiding Place as well, they have important stories to tell, but they're painful stories. And what's it like for you as actors to, you mentioned it is somewhat depressing. Could you comment on that?
Yeah. Well, I honestly find it to be really kind of enlightening in a way. I mean, one of the things that I think is so important about telling these stories is that we are able to connect and kind of gain an understanding of what different people have gone through. And from an acting perspective, it's this kind of thrilling, but to try to wrap your head around some of the things that other people have gone through. I mean, we are so lucky. Mm-hmm. Speaking to a little bit depressing on props, just, I mean, in doing The Hiding Place, we're going to do our best to give that time and period justice and not hide.
Sure.
The brutality.
A lot of swastikas.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of swastikas. Yeah. possibly showcasing some of the brutality. Mm-hmm. And it's, to be truthful storytelling, I mean, we have to go there, you know?
It's interesting. You say the process is depressing. The process
can be depressing because, you know, this is about stories, right? And stories have conflict. And this particular conflict is about the Nazis and the Holocaust. And so as you explore that process, it can be overwhelming. Ultimately, the story we're telling is hopeful.
That is true.
But in order to come through and realize that hope and that ability to forgive in what on the surface seems unforgivable, you do have to sort of go through that depressing process, and that has to be real and have weight in order for the payoff to have the power that it does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's just so important. I think, you know, as Hank can speak to, just how necessary it is for us to tell these stories, mm-hmm. so that, especially in this day and time, we don't forget.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hank?
This is a pretty magnificent night, and I knew this would be good, but it's much more poignant than I thought. And Tatiana's right. We had this great discussion, and that's exactly what you want to be able to do. You want to be able to create these kind of discussions. You know, something that Warren said earlier when he said that this is a play that will take us back in time and tell a story about the years leading up to the Holocaust. What we have to remember is that this isn't really taking us back in time. This is reminding us of the present. Mm. This is so, so current. You know, less than 2% of high school graduates have ever heard the adage, Arbach mach frei, which was, of course, at the front check-in gate at both Dachau and Auschwitz-Birkenau. They don't know what it means. Mm. Work will make you free was the greatest world lie. And it speaks to the tragedy of what we now know, and that being that we still hate, we are still afraid, and as long as we experience fear and hatred, this will never go away. I'm afraid that we still live in a society that's very passive and compliant. You know, tolerance is active. We have to be able to do something about that. It's kind of interesting in a way, if I may, when I got active as a docent in the Holocaust Museum, it wasn't to be a docent at all, despite my background, my mother and my grandparents being survivors, and another 16 relatives who I never met because they were killed. It turned out in 1996, when the museum opened, the original museum opened, the first rotating exhibit was 7 entries that were found from the old Anne Frank Journal. And the white supremacists came out in force, and they put a lot of graffiti on the front doors of the museum. And I was called because at the time I was teaching negotiation. Warren knows in my other life I was a negotiator. And I was actually called by HPD to work with them to deal with the skinheads. Now, I didn't know anything about gang psychology, and neither did the two officers with whom I was assigned. We were sent to the museum for training on gang psychology. Huh. And I sat there, and I learned something about gang psychology. And fortunately, I didn't really have to deal with the skinheads. The cops took care of it. But I sat there and I was embarrassed. And that's when my life changed. I realized I had to do something. So I applied to be a docent. I wasn't there to be one, but I applied. And you have to apply, and only about 20% become docents. It's a big deal. It is a huge, huge deal. But, you know, this reading tonight is pretty magnificent on so many different levels. You know, what you're dealing with tonight is an incredible case study. And then when you go to the museum, you find out that the Holocaust is a case study for hatred. You know, 11.5 million people were killed. Jews were not the only victims, but all of the Jews were slated for extermination. And at the museum, the new museum, what used to be the core, will now be the Holocaust Gallery. And then there will also be a civil rights exhibit, a stationary civil rights exhibit, which is important. Because unless we learn from the Holocaust how hatred is bad, the Holocaust will be meaningless. Jews, mm-hmm. one of the things I'm very proud of in Judaism is that it's the only religion that makes very clear that we cannot protect ourselves until we protect the rest of humanity. Mm. We have to stop hatred among all of the world. And that sounds sometimes a little tacky, but my God, it's true, and I love that. And that's what you're bringing out in this theme tonight. Beyond the civil rights corridors, and this is something that Warren and any storyteller is going to love, they're going to have an exhibit on diaries. Mm-hmm. There were thousands of teenagers who wrote diaries during the war. and I've shared some of them in my own classes, not just my storytelling class, but also my communication theory course, where I talk about the narrative paradigm, a theory in storytelling, how people are natural storytellers, because people are natural storytellers. And when you listen to individuals at the museum, you know that. Thank you so much for this great evening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I know everybody in this room, we were just discussing, is going on a tour next week at the new reopened Holocaust Museum.
Yeah, I can't wait.
Now, before we go off the air, I always like to give artists a chance to mention what they've got coming up next in their performing life or in the theater's life.
Sure. Well, at the 80 Players, we're opening West Side Story in just a couple of weeks. And it's by far the biggest show that we have ever tried to tackle, and that's why it's in our season. We feel it's important to maybe put something in our season that scares us a little bit, that we set the bar a little higher than we think we can reach. And we saw a designer run the other day, and it's absolutely amazing.
I saw the video on your website.
That's incredible. My wife.
That was incredible, Jennifer.
Thank you. We had a lot of fun making that.
How about you, Shelby?
Oh, well, I'm working at the 80 Players. I'm also
working
trucking it with West Side Story, yeah. But we have a lot of other things coming up next season, in addition to The Hiding Place, that a lot of period pieces I'm very excited about. So.
Cool. Jennifer?
Yeah, actually, I'm having come off of directing Collected Stories, taking a little bit of a breather break. Kevin is going to be directing The Hiding Place, and so I'm going to play mom for a little while while he's in rehearsal. So that's my next job.
Well, wonderful. It's hard to believe, but we're out of time. So Jennifer, Kevin, Shelby, thank you for being with us on So What's Your Story?
Oh, our pleasure. Thank you so much for having us.
We're going to go off the air tonight with a song that encapsulates what the Holocaust Museum Houston and tonight's story, Rivka's story, are all about. The song is Light One Candle by Peter, Paul, and Mary. Lars is up next with a sweet mix of singer-songwriters on the Tennyson tapes. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story, and treasure what you hear. You keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Warren Holloman, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after.
Don't set the light out, let it shine through a lament of tears.
Light one candle for the strength that we need to never become our own foe. And light one candle for those who are suffering pain we learned so long ago. Light one candle for all we believe in, that anger not tear us apart.
If you decided to donate your birthday to KPFT this year, thank you. If your special day hasn't yet arrived, consider donating your birthday to KPFT. Here's how it works. Facebook sends you a prompt before your birthday asking if you'd like to donate your birthday to a nonprofit. Select KPFT as your organization of choice. Then add a personalized message so that your friends know how much KPFT means to you. On your birthday, they'll receive a Facebook notification asking them to make a donation in your honor to KPFT. Thanks again for supporting 90.1 FM KPFT Houston, Pacifica Radio for Peace.
KPFT's 2019 Local Station Board election is underway. A donation of $25 by June 30th gives you the right to vote. Want to do more than donate? Consider running as a candidate to serve on your local station board. Visit elections.pacifica.org and cast your candidacy by completing the nomination package before June 30th. E-ballots will be issued to members with an email. Members in need of a paper ballot can email NES
pacifica.org or leave a voicemail at 510-854-9663, indicating their full name, address, and telephone number. Please help make this election green by filling out a ballot request form on elections.pacifica.org, indicating the email you would like us to use to send you a ballot. Ballots go out August 15th.